Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions expressed on Wolf Dog Radio by our guests and call-in listeners are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of the production team of the hosts of Wolf Dog Radio. We are open to your ideas for future radio programs. Please feel free to email us with questions or comments at questions@wolfdogradio.com.
I'm George Stapleton, and welcome to Wolf Dog Radio. Call me Dave. Those were some of the first few words I heard from him. Come join us and let Dave tell you about the International Wolf Center in Ely, Minnesota. Listen to a man speak with passion and an understanding that few of us, and maybe none of us, will ever have about wolves. Dave will tell us of the projects he's involved with and share with us his thoughts about wolves in Europe. His conversation sparks thoughts of the current fate of the wolf in France and the numbers he shares that we can now know are less than when we did this interview. He speaks about wolves in places we have heard and confirms interesting geographic locations of wolf populations. He talks about feelings that come from both sides of the wolf issue, why romanticizing the wolf is something we all do and differently. Dave tells us about why the dominance theory is no longer applicable to wolves and the packs they create, why wolf packs are more like human families. He is an icon, and we can learn much from him. We'll be right back after these messages from Blue Buffalo.
He's a dog in every sense, yet in his soul, he's a wolf. Inside every dog lives a spiritual connection to his ancestors in the wild, and nothing connects them more than a desire for meat. So we created Blue Wilderness. It's made with more of the meat your dog loves. Feed the wolf that lives inside your dog with meat-rich Blue Wilderness.
This is Paula Ficarra
and Steve Westell,
founders of Apex Protection Project,
and you're listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Today we're speaking with Dr. David Meach. I'm sure most of you know who that is, and we have some topics that we're going to be discussing. We're going to let Dave speak and talk to us about a lot of different things. And Dave, I wanted to thank you so much for taking some time to spend with us today. And on a personal note, just I'm thrilled to be speaking with you.
Well, I'm glad to do it.
So let's just get right into this. Tell us about the Wolf Center, the International Wolf Center in Ely. What's happening? What's going on? What's news? I know that it's part of your life, so I just would love to hear about it. Tell me all about it.
Well, I would say the most exciting thing going on at the Wolf Center right now is that we have a couple of Arctic wolf pups. They're pretty rare, and we obtained those this spring, and they're hand reared because we need to have them tractable enough to be able to administer vaccines and medicines and that type of thing. And so, of course, they're very large now. They're essentially adult size. They, as you probably know, wolves grow very quickly and develop, and basically by fall, the pups are essentially adult size. They're not really mature at that time. That's true not just of Arctic wolves, but of wolves in general. They don't mature until somewhere between 2 and 4 years of age. But anyway, so we have these two Arctic wolf pups there, and people have been just really excited to see them. We've had the best year of visitation in several, and we hope that that will continue for the next few years while we have these animals in their large enclosure where people can actually get a chance to see them, because it's very rare to see Arctic wolves even in captivity. So that's the most exciting thing going on there now.
Well, that's amazing. So when a guest comes and visits the facility up there, what can they expect to learn about? What is it that the Wolf Center is really focused on teaching people?
Well, our whole objective really is to provide science-based objective information about wolves. The reason that's so important is because, as you've already mentioned, wolves are really very controversial. On both extremes, we have some people who really, really hate wolves, and they think the only good wolf is a dead wolf. That's been a slogan for many years of some of these folks. On the other hand, we have other people who revere wolves so much that they don't ever want to see any wolf killed. And of course, there's every viewpoint in between. There's a whole continuum. But it's the ones on the extreme ends of this whole continuum who really get the press and promote their viewpoints, which end up being quite propagandistic. That is, not necessarily the truth, but propaganda. And it's hard for the media to really distinguish propaganda from the real truth. So the Wolf Center is dedicated to doing that. In other words, just trying to stick to science-based information and promoting that in several ways. Now, you know, I mentioned the Wolf Center having these Arctic wolf pups. This is a way, just by displaying these animals, of at least showing what they're like. But besides just seeing the wolves themselves, visitors to the center get a chance to hear various lectures from wolf authorities, people who know what they're talking about. We have a large exhibit called the Wolves and Humans exhibit that gives the basic facts about wolves on both sides of the question. I mean, it is certainly true that wolves do some, they conflict with humans in some cases. There's no question about it. On the other hand, the degree of conflict is usually nowhere near as strong as so many people who don't like wolves make it out to be. So anyway, the information in that exhibit, in the Wolves and Humans exhibit at the Wolf Center, that information is factual about both sides of the wolf controversy. And then there's a chance to see various videos and films about wolves that the Wolf Center feels are accurate. I mentioned the lectures. There's also a bookstore and with selling books that basically are science-based. And then we have a website, www.wolf.org. And that's seen by over a million people a year and is loaded with factual information about wolves. And there's a Facebook page and Twitter and all that stuff. So all of this is devoted to basically promoting factual information about wolves. So that's what the whole center is about. And whether a person has a chance to actually visit the center, which is in Ely, E-L-Y, Ely, Minnesota, in northeastern part of the state, right in the center of major wolf range, whether a person gets a chance to visit that center or just gets a chance to go online and look at the information there, either way, they're getting factual information, and that's what we're all about.
That is so amazing. So can I ask, does the Wolf Center have a position on wolves in North America? Well, let me focus that more, not just North America. Let's just focus on the United States. So if the Wolf Center were to promote a position or can they, do they, will they, promote a position on wolves in America in the wild? Is it, I mean, I think from an ecological standpoint, we all understand the concept of trophic cascades and the predator and prey species and all that, but in this day and age, reality, I guess, in where does the Wolf Center stand on that, or could you speak to that?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that, because that's something I overlooked. In fact, the answer is the Wolf Center does not take a stand on anything. Obviously, the Wolf Center is dedicated to the concept of wolf conservation. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing. But in terms of specific
right.
issues, we do not take a position. I mean, if someone asks, what is your position on hunting wolves, or what is your position on getting wolves off the endangered species list, or what is your position on wolf depredation control, we have no position. And we just provide, if someone asks those questions, we're quite willing to give information about the question. So if someone asks, what do you think about hunting and trapping wolves? Well, you know, we're glad to say what states allow it, and what are the, say, regulations and quotas and things like that. We're glad to show where wolves are protected, fully protected, like in national parks and some of the states where they're still fully protected under the Endangered Species Act. But we don't have a position deliberately, because once you take a position, then all of a sudden you end up possibly giving information that only supports your position. And we don't do that. We give information that is factual regardless of what where it comes down on that continuum of pro and anti-wolf.
It's great to know that there's an organization out there that really is looking at science-based. And you know, I have a little slogan of mine. What do we want at science-based evidence? When do we want it after peer review? And I'm assuming we're talking on the same note there, that, you know, when we're talking more scientific-based evidence, that it has been peer-reviewed, so therefore it isn't just an opinion, but more of a fact statement. Would that be an accurate description of what the Wolf Center puts out?
Yeah, we just try to be accurate with our information. I mean, that's the way it is.
So it leads me to this question, and it isn't really so much about the Wolf Center. So your involvement with the Wolf Center, and I understand that. So do you ever find that there's a little bit of conflict on because of your professional position as a biologist?
Yes.
Because you probably do have some things to say about these things. And so you have to distinguish, I would assume, when you're speaking for the Wolf Center and when you're speaking for Dr. Meats. Would that be accurate assessment?
Yes, you're correct there. And I understand how people can get that confused. I really do not try to speak for the Wolf Center. I try to let the Wolf Center speak for itself. We have people there who can do that. I have to remember that I work, first of all, for the U.S. Geological Survey, the federal government, and so there are certain restrictions there. Just as a professional wolf scientist, I do have viewpoints on things, in a lot of respects, I'm allowed to actually give those viewpoints. The Wolf Center has to just, as I say, keep things just the way they don't provide viewpoint, their own viewpoint. But I can,
sure.
And I on various things. And I depending on what the question is and what the specific venue is, I can certainly speak to these things. So if somebody asks me, have wolves recovered enough in some given state so that you think that they are fully recovered, I can answer that question. And I have to do that every now and then. I do get asked that. Sometimes I get asked that in courts and things. And so, and I can, as a biologist, I can give you that information. So I try to, when I am speaking, like when you ask me questions, I will be speaking as a professional wolf biologist, not as a member of the Wolf Center.
That's good to know, because that's where we'll probably close out our piece on the Wolf Center, unless there's something else.
No, I think we've pretty well covered that one.
Can you speak to what is happening with the wolf in Europe?
My understanding of that is extremely limited, so talk to me like anyone else who has no clue what's going on out there.
Okay, well, you might then be surprised that Germany now has quite a population of wolves. And and they've even gotten up into Denmark. This is, you know, pretty new. In Germany, they came over from Poland, and there's something on the order of, about a couple hundred wolves or so in Germany now. And, of course, France has them. They came in from Italy. When I started working with wolves, Italy had very few, like 100 or so. They're up to 1,000 or so, and they've spread all over Italy, and then, as I say, up into France. And Spain has got a couple thousand. Of course, Norway and Sweden and Finland. Now, there's, between Norway and Sweden, there's close to somewhere around 400, 300, 300 to 400, somewhere in there. And then a couple hundred, at least, maybe 300 or so in Finland. So they are really returning to many areas where 30, 40, 50 years ago they were wiped out. What's happening is that we're seeing the same kind of conflicts in those countries as we see in North America or in the U.S., wolves are, many people really like them, but wolves are killing livestock, and so ranchers and farmers are upset with them. Some people are really afraid of them. We can go into that later on if you want about fear of wolves, but fact is there are a lot of people who are really afraid of them, and so as wolves come back into areas where they haven't been for 50 or more years, they are causing both joy on one end of the extreme and consternation on the other end, just like we see in the United States.
Well, is there more, and again, we'll get into the fear of wolves a little later, but would the fear be a little deeper for Europeans? I mean, it seems that a lot of the fear of the wolf, or the lore, if you will, the behind fear of wolves came from Europe, you know? I mean... we did.
Yes, I think you're right. Yeah,
and so we just didn't come forth with this idea that wolves are bad and they will kill people here in the U.S. So I guess in some ways maybe they're more enlightened, because with the numbers you said, I mean, I just roughly we're talking a little less than 5,000 wolves, but in just in Central Europe area, that's huge. I mean, you're talking about landmass area of what, maybe the southwest part of the United States equal to in size, and having that many wolves in that location?
Well, in the southwestern U.S., that population's up to a minimum of 113 now. That you're talking about the Mexican wolf there, I think. And And you mentioned the difference, if there is a difference in the degree of fear of wolves. I do think that certainly in the Scandinavian countries, and this is seat of the pants, I don't have good data on this. It's just my impression from reading materials from these areas and knowing some of the folks there. My impression is the folks in the Scandinavian countries fear wolves more than people in say in Spain and Italy and all, and I'm not exactly sure why that is, but the feelings seem, well, for that matter, the feelings seem to be strong on both sides that way. In other words, there's a strong feeling on the part of say folks in Norway, some of the folks in Norway, that trying to control a population of wolves there is wrong. And yet the government right now, because of people on the other side of the issue, is trying to assert some control of their wolves. And so you get the same controversies that we have here, but they seem to be more extreme over there. And I don't know whether it's I'm not sure why it is, but I think you probably did hit on something there that they do seem to be fighting a little harder over there. But anyway, it is certainly true that wolves have proliferated in so many of the European countries, Western Europe, where they hadn't been 20, 30 years ago.
So would that be nature or human enhanced?
No, that is nature.
Humans had to start it, but was
well, yes and no. Humans, yes, because wolves became protected by the European Union,
mm-hmm.
and once that protection started, then it allowed wolves from these other areas. Like I mentioned, a reservoir of 100 in Italy in the early 70s. That they have proliferated, expanded into France, and actually getting into Switzerland as well, and then those in Poland, they've expanded and gotten into Germany into Denmark, and that's because they are protected. Now that doesn't mean they're not killed, because for one thing, there's always poaching that goes on in all of these countries, but the human aspect of that effect of that is because of the fact that in the countryside in Europe, so many people have abandoned those areas and moved into the cities, that the amount of poaching has dropped because there aren't so many people in the countryside to begin with. And so that plus the actual legal protection has allowed the wolves to expand throughout the area. So, yes, human caused because of changes in laws, but then natural because the wolves having such a high biotic potential just did what nature does for them, and they just expanded everywhere. As you know, wolves, each wolf pack produces annually an average litter size of about 6 pups. And so wolves can easily double their numbers in a year that way. And that's what they do when they have enough food and enough protection. And that's what they basically did in Europe, is just proliferate all over the place.
Is there a point in that development of those wolves in Europe where they will outgrow their ability to provide sustenance or survivability for themselves in land and prey?
Well, yes, eventually, you know, they will continue to proliferate as long as there's enough food. Once they hit, you know, the limits of the food supply, then they can no longer stop. They can no longer continue to expand. But it is based on the food supply. In other words, as long as there's enough food in enough areas, they'll continue to not just increase in the same area, but also expand and recolonize new areas where there's more food. So that continues to go on until the point where, you know, they've basically reached I don't want to call it a balance, but they've reached sort of the limits of their food supply. It's more of a carrying capacity is what we would call it. And at that point, of course, then their numbers will no longer increase. But what's going on in Europe right now and in much of the U.S. is that there's plenty of food all over and the wolves just keep expanding. So we're in that phase both in Europe and in the U.S. where they're expanding.
Right. And because they are an apex predator in the top of their food chain, I hope I'm using that term correctly, they really have no natural predators. And the only thing they would be have competition from other predators. So they in theory, wolves can continue to proliferate with a food source that's unchecked.
Yeah, that's true. And as far as the competing predators are concerned, wolves do very well there. When you say they're at the top, they are at the top, including they seem to be able to outcompete both cougars and bears, which would be their main competitors. So they're not really limited by their competitors. Sometimes diseases hit them, but not enough to really corral their numbers very much. Now and then, you get diseases like dog diseases like distemper, and for a while there in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s, we were getting parvovirus in wolves, and it was holding the parvovirus affects mostly the pups. That was holding some populations down for a while, but that's over with now. I think wolves have pretty much gotten resistant to that. So really, yes, it's just the food supply is really the main limitation on wolves now. In some areas, poaching is. In other words, let me just give you a good example. Would be wolves in the western U.S. They proliferated from Montana and Idaho and Wyoming, proliferated from there into Oregon and Washington, and even from there to California, as you no doubt are aware. But they have not proliferated into Colorado.
Right.
And the reason for that is just simply the area there, the habitat is pretty open, and wolves are... And there's plenty of cattle in that area. And so wolves get in there. They kill livestock. The government has to come in and take care of that. So they kill the wolves. And then wolves are poached. And that's preventing wolves from repopulating south, even though they were able to repopulate to the west because it was forested and fewer livestock.
I'm in Colorado, and I've been to quite a few of the wolf seminars and the different programs of potential reintroduction, and I even have a copy of the draft that the environmental impact statement that the Fish and Wildlife Service did a few years back. But I want to switch back to Western Europe real quickly on one thing. So are all of these animals in Europe, not just Western, but of the countries we talked about and those populations, are they all – okay, so I'm kind of a geek, and I understand that everything's Canis lupus, but are these specific types of wolves that we're talking about?
No, they are basically the same as we have here. It's true that, for example, in size, there's some differences. You get down into Israel, for example, and incidentally, wolves live throughout the Midwest, the Mideast, sorry. The wolves in Israel are smaller, noticeably smaller than the wolves, say, in the United States. On the other hand, the wolves in the United States are smaller than the wolves in Canada. These differences with the north-south difference and that type of thing. But basically, wolves everywhere around the world are the same species and can interbreed.
That's very helpful. So the last, you opened up two questions there that I really love, because I read a paper in Israel that was from the Middle East, and it was written, I think, in 2009 about the viability of wolves mating with feral dogs, and they had some actual evidence, photographic evidence, nothing that showed live pups, but they did show breeding behavior between a feral male dog and a Middle Eastern wild wolf, and I wondered if you had anything to say about that.
Well, that does happen. Generally, when that happens in the wild like that, you do get some hybrids, and those hybrids they're wolf dogs, basically, like hybrids that people raise. But they pretty well backbreed mostly with wolves, and so the dog part of them is pretty well diminished after a few generations. So you don't get populations generally of wolf-dog hybrids living in the wild.
Well,
you do get occasional breeding like that, but not populations.
Would the female more than likely in that kind of a situation, would she be most likely to kill the pups if she didn't feel that they were, I'm anthropomorphizing horribly here, but if a female wolf gives birth to a litter and it somehow senses that it's not right, would it even allow those pups to live? Would it feed them?
As far as I know, they continue to raise them. I don't think they reject them in any way. I haven't heard anything about like that.
So Dave, I've seen this. There was a New York Times article where I think they referred to you. I saw it on Carter Niemeyer's Facebook page, of all places. And I read the article, and it was very cool. It was really well balanced. I didn't care much for the picture of wolves holding rifles, but hey, who cares? You know, that's editorial. That's journalism. But there was a piece that kind of stuck with me in there about romanticizing the wolf. And since I feel that I am one of those guilty people, I romanticize the wolf. I honestly believe that when I'm in their presence, and I've not been in the presence of wild wolves, but only captive and higher content wolf dogs, I feel what I consider to be a palpable physical change, which is probably all in my head, all derived from some emotional response that I get in connection with wolves. Anyway, I am that extreme side probably of wanting to see wolves and maybe not having a really good understanding. So take us through the romanticism of wolf in America. What is it a danger to? Why is it a danger? What do we need to be aware of, and how do we temper that as individuals, whether we are fearful of the wolf or whether we embrace the wolf?
Boy, I don't know, because that's pretty hard. I mean, it's hard for me. I have to, you know, I'm in an awkward position in that respect, and I've seen, you know, both sides of the wolf, and I have to remain as cold and objective as I can when I see some of these things. I think the wolf is such a beautiful animal. It can understand a person getting emotional about them, and I've been on top of them when they've been killing, ripping an animal apart, you know, and even including I've been close to them when they've been tearing into their own kind, which is not really that much fun to see. And yet I have to remain about as objective as I can about all that stuff. And I think I've been able to do a pretty good job of it after all these years, but it is a constant battle. And so I understand when an individual, any layperson with a specific background, say a farmer who comes out and finds, one of his cattle completely torn apart in the pasture, or someone comes home and finds the dog that they had tied up out front, they just find the head left and part of the leash or something. I understand their feeling of hatred, but on the other hand, I understand when a person looks at a beautiful wild wolf in full winter coat and all, how they can, you know, see that animal as an extremely beautiful creature, and not want to see that animal in any way killed or maligned. It's easy to understand all that. So I don't have any advice for people. I mean, you just have to, depending on your own background, you have to feel the way you do, and hopefully try to understand how someone with a different background and a different set of experiences would see it in a different way. Just try to understand that. But that's as far as I can go on that, I'm afraid. Emotions are emotions, you know. We all have them. We're all human.
Yeah. My personal experience, I relayed just a little bit of that to you, was in Catron County with the Mexican gray wolf and the wolf-proof bus stops that were built there because of the children. And, you know, what I found in that meeting was that the families who were raising cattle down there had valid fears, and they weren't being addressed. And I think that as a wildlife enthusiast and a little bit of an ecologist and, you know, environmentalist and all this other, I think that if we open our minds and our hearts and maybe our intellect to the other side's argument and at least check it out. I mean, really, were wolves in Catron County really need wolf-proof bus stops because they were, you know, messing with children? I mean, was that really a necessary thing? And after I spent a few weeks there and talked to them, I found that, you know what, it wasn't. But there was predation. It did exist. But I think people just want to be heard, and maybe what we can do to help with the romanticism of the wolf in America is try to listen with our intellect to the other side.
yeah, that's about as good as it gets, really. You got to try to look at it that way and put your emotions aside and, as you say, look at it with your intellect and try to view the situation rationally. That's all any of us can do, really.
Dave, do you have just maybe a couple or 3 minutes to go over the dominant wolf pack versus the familial wolf pack?
The issue comes down to the, not so much to the dominance, but to the question of the viewpoint of the alpha animal, as though, I mean, that idea comes from, you know, the behavioral literature where the dominance hierarchy and the pecking order in chickens and that kind of thing. And historically, we have looked at the wolf as an animal that gains its top position as breeder by fighting off other wolves and sort of climbing the social ladder to the top. That's not the way it works. The way a wolf becomes a breeder is just merely the same way humans do. You mature, you meet a member of the opposite sex, you set up your territory, and you mate, and you produce your offspring, and you are automatically then the top member of your family, just like a human male or female is the top member of their family. And therefore, the old term that we used to use that implied that you fought to get to the top, is we no longer use that. We haven't used that now. Science doesn't use that, hasn't used that in almost 20 years. We just call these animals either the male breeder or the female breeder, or the adult male, the adult female, or the breeding male, or you can call it the father wolf. I mean, that's what it is. If it's the you know, if it's the one who was the progenitor of the pack and the mother wolf and their offspring, and that's what a pack is. So the term alpha now we don't use. Now, that isn't to say that, and some people get confused on this, that isn't to say that those adult wolves are not dominant to the offspring. They are, and they show that dominance. So dominance is still part of wolf behavior. The issue is really calling the animal an alpha as though it fought to get its dominance. It didn't fight to get to it. It just met a member of the opposite sex, had offspring, and then automatically became dominant to the offspring, just like human parents are dominant to their offspring until the offspring reach a certain age, and then they disperse and go off and do the same thing.
It's a lot clearer to understand that the dominance is there, but not a bunch of wolves are fighting to create packs. I mean, that's kind of what you get a little bit of, and it sounds like that's just, it's more, I don't want to say, I guess, human than that. Two animals.
It's just really automatic.
Yeah,
when you're an adult and you produce these offspring, you're automatically dominant to those offspring. Again, the analogy to a human family is very close.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. That's some amazing stuff. So there's actually just one other topic. If you don't have time, that's great. We were just going to briefly discuss the Isle Royal wolves, and the only thing I thought was the population that was heard was the population had dwindled to two.
It has.
And daughter.
Yes. Yeah.
So are they done? Is Isle Royal finally done?
Well, when those two are gone, it will be. But then the Park Service has proposed reintroducing wolves. And my guess is that probably will happen, although, you know, there's not a final decision on it, but there is a proposal.
Thank you so much, Dave. I am just appreciative of all your time.
Well, you're welcome, George. Glad to do it. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
We will be right back after these messages from the Texas Wolf Project.
Hello, this is Natasha Woodall, Vice President of Texas Wolf Dog Project in Chester. We are an all-volunteer and donation-based 501c3 rescue and adoption facility dedicated to saving as many adoptable wolf dogs and northern breed dogs in the state of Texas, as well as surrounding areas. This is based off of available foster homes, suitable adoptive homes, and, of course, financial resources for veterinary care. We support responsible ownership and public education, as well as promoting education for other rescue groups, shelters, and animal control facilities concerning proper wolf dog identification, evaluation, and care. For more information on adoption, events, volunteer work, and how to donate, please visit our website at www.texaswolfdogproject.org or email us at info@texaswolfdogproject.org or visit us on Facebook. Thank you.
For tonight's
this
Operation
is Rachel
Rescue,
Tilsa, and you are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
For tonight's Operation Rescue, we are playing an interview from Project Coyote's Camilla Fox and the lead guitarist for Queen, Brian May. It details the sad similarities of wildlife conservation that we share with our brother and sisters in the United Kingdom.
I'm here with Brian May, who is the lead guitarist with Queen, and I'm totally thrilled to have this opportunity to talk to you. And I know when you originally reached out to me, you expressed some of the parallels that you saw with what's going on with badgers and foxes in England and what we're dealing with coyotes and wolves and foxes in this country. And I was wondering if you could speak to that, those parallels.
Yes, in England it's foxes who have been traditionally for a couple of hundred years hunted for sport, for the enjoyment of people watching packs of dogs tear them apart. And the barbarity of that I find staggering, but there are very large and very rich pressure groups in England that want to, that to continue. It was actually outlawed by the Hunting Act about 20 years ago. But there's a very powerful lobby trying to bring all the blood sports back into Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we started. I had this campaign called Save Me, which is about giving wild animals a voice. And it started off with foxes. It's now very much concerned with badgers too, because badgers are being blamed for the spread of a disease, which actually, of course, is spread by intensive farming. So the badgers are being scapegoated, and our government is conducting a war on wildlife, really. And at the moment, hundreds are being shot down, being gunned down. There is no independent monitoring to see if it's being done humanely. They're destroying badger families. Badgers are very much indigenous to England. They had their family groups in Britain long before there were humans there. They mind their own business. They're very family orientated. So if you shoot a badger, you destroy the family, obviously.
Mm.
And very often the cubs will die of starvation. It's really a very grim prospect. So this is what we fight. And up to now, we haven't won, because we have a government which, no matter how much evidence is put before them, will not change. They have certain vested interest, they have made promises to certain groups, and it's a political decision. It doesn't matter how much scientific evidence, and there is a lot, to say that culling badgers won't work, they will still do it. So it's a fight for decency, and I've come to realize over the last 3 years that what you're fighting is not just the symptom, it's not just people being cruel to animals. There is something underneath that, and I believe what's underneath it is, in our case, privilege. It's a way of thinking which says we can do anything we like to people or animals, and you will not stop us, because this is our power, this is traditionally what we're allowed to do. And that is what our government at the moment stands for. It's not the will of the people that we are cruel to animals. The vast majority of people are decent and realize that animals have feelings like we do. But there's a certain section, and a very powerful section of the community, which is determined to keep the old barbarity going.
The perspective of our governments of coyotes and wolves and foxes has been one of vermin often.
Mm.
And yet we know ecologically that they're so incredibly important now.
Mm.
So, you know, I look at those same things that we're facing politically in our two respective countries and the forces that we're up against.
Mm.
You know, and you've probably seen we're challenging a practice called penning, where they take foxes and coyotes and they put them in pens and they let dogs basically rip them apart. And like bounties and killing contests. You know, these are largely legal by many states, and yet, you know, we have like your country, when you actually go out to the people and say, do you accept this? Most people would say no. Killing contests have been going on for a long while.
Okay.
But in Idaho, what's new is the fact that wolves are being targeted. And as you probably know, we reintroduced wolves. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to reintroduce them. And now we're trophy hunting them, we're trapping them, and now killing them in these killing contests.
The idea of killing for pleasure, I still find completely baffling. And it's almost like we're two different races that are on this planet. It seems like human beings are split. I don't know what the percentages are, but most people, I would say, are decent and understand that every person deserves respect, and actually every creature deserves respect, whether you like it or not. It has a right to a decent life and a decent death, and that's what we're all entitled to. But there is a certain section of the community who think that it's okay, in fact that it's great, to kill things for pleasure, not just for food, but for pleasure. And it seems like they will never change. It seems like this problem won't go away, because people will always have this desire in their body to cause pain. And obviously the FBI will tell you there's a great link between people who like to cause pain in animals with people who like to cause pain in human beings. So it's a trait in humans which is evil, which is very, very, very bad, but it's not going to go away overnight. Once you've seen the depths of depravity that people will sink to in abusing animals, you have it in your body and you know it, and you can't unknow it. And it becomes part of your life to try and save animals from this terrible fate that they have. And hopefully things will improve. I believe they will improve, because we abolished slavery, we got women the vote, we don't burn witches at the stake anymore. We should not be torturing animals in any shape or form.
My hope is in the youth, and I do think that people in general are born with a certain amount of empathy and compassion, and we desensitize through so many different ways of society. So I guess I have hope in some ways of young people that will continue to connect with others beyond humans.
You can tell with people as soon as you meet them, can't you? Because if they use the word vermin, you know immediately. Because what is vermin? It's something which you don't think ought to be there because it inconveniences you, something you think is dirty or is going to hurt you in some way, something that you fear. They all have a legitimate right to live on this planet the same as we do. Why would we deny them that? So many of our assumptions are wrong, the ones that we were brought up with, which... And these false claims of animals vindicated our right to raise them for food and abuse them. I mean, the way that veal is treated, the way that the cows are treated to make veal, the way birds are force-fed to make foie gras, you know, all these disgusting, abusive, painful processes are all justified by saying, oh, animals don't have feelings. Humans act because of reason. Animals act on instinct. Well, it ain't true. There is not that sharp dividing line, and you see it in every animal that you interact with. The more you get to know an animal, the more you understand that it has a thought process which may not be inferior to your own. There's so much evidence, for instance, dolphins. Dolphins seem to be using their brain in a more effective way than humans. They seem to be using a larger portion of their brain than we do.
I think the more that we study animals, the more that we're seeing not just intelligence, but an emotional life and cultures and dialects and families.
An emotional intelligence. And why would we think that our intelligence is better than theirs?
Mm-hmm.
See, I come from an astronomy background, and it used to be thought that the Earth was the center of the universe. Everything revolved around the Earth, the moon, the sun, the stars. And gradually it was discovered that this is not the case. Actually, we're not in the center even of our own little family of planets. The sun is the center. The sun is not the center of our galaxy. It's a tiny little speck in a corner of our galaxy. Our galaxy is not the center of the rest of the galaxies in the universe. You know, we are not central in any way whatsoever. So why would we think that the human race is central or more important than any of the other creatures on this planet?
So Brian, if someone were to say to you, what can I do? You know, I'm just one person. How can I make a difference? What would you say to them?
I'd say to people, get connected. to an organization that is dealing with this and contribute in the media, talk, spread the word, question practices which you think don't look right. And it can be anything. You can see perhaps you see people selling pets in the street. You know, ask where they come from, ask why they're not with their parents, ask if they are truly rescued, you know, are they being bred for money when there's animals that are waiting in rescue homes the whole time. Ask questions like that. Ask people, you know, ask how dogs are treated if they're pets. Ask how the animals are treated that make your food that you eat every day. Find out. And if you're not happy with the way that's discovered to be, then do something about it. Make a noise, speak, join organizations, donate to organizations, but most of all, speak up and say, we are not going to put up with this.
Mm. Well, again, I'm so grateful for all that you're doing in England for the badgers, the foxes. And
okay, well, we are uniting. It's very important that around the world we unite, because it's a very global thing. There are bastards in every country at the moment. And they need to be contained, and they need to take out their evil, cruel intentions in a harmless way somehow. You know, let's get them converted to video games or something, you know, but just stop them feeling that they have the right to abuse another creature.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you.
For more information on this subject and many others pertaining to wildlife conservation, please go to www.projectcoyote.org. This is also a great place to volunteer your time or to donate. That's www.projectcoyote.org. Please join us now for In the News with Greg Largent.
Greg Largent with Tuesday, August 15th, in the news for Wolf Dog Radio. We have three or four items tonight. The first, Wisconsin tradition, hunting bears with dogs, comes under attack by wolf advocates. This is from the Star Tribune, Josephine Marcotti, dated August 11th of 2017. A national watchdog group says Wisconsin bear hunters are harassing wolves with their dog packs, then claiming state compensation when their hounds are killed, and wants the federal government to launch a criminal investigation into the matter. The practice amounts to, quote, state-sanctioned financially subsidizing for hunters engaged in the criminal harassment, unquote, of wolves. An attorney for the Public Employees for Environment Responsibility, or PEER, said in a letter to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In 2016, Wisconsin paid out just over $99,000 for 41 dogs, a maximum of $2,500 each. The dogs were killed primarily in July and August, when hunters are in the woods training their pack to chase bears and wolf pups are first emerging from their dens. More than a dozen dogs were killed despite caution warnings by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, that wolf packs with pups were active in the areas, Pierce said. It's harassment of an endangered species committed by a relatively small number of hunters, said Adam Carlesco, the staff counsel for Pierce. He said Wisconsin is the only state that reimburses dog owners in addition to farmers and livestock owners for wolf depredation. The president of the Wisconsin Bear Association called Pierce's allegations absurd, and said that most hunters try to avoid wolves, even as their population expands. Pierce has no idea what it costs to raise, feed, and maintain a good hunting dog, said Carl Schottel. The state's financial compensation is a fraction of what the loss is, plus the emotional cost to your children's hunting dog and yours also. Officials from the Wisconsin Fish and Wildlife Service said they received the letter, but they haven't decided how to respond. Pierce's actions have identified the long-running conflict between wolf advocates and some in the Wisconsin hunting community about the use of dogs to pursue prey. Wisconsin was the only state that allowed the use of dogs to hunt wolves when they were temporarily removed from federal threatened species protection between 2012 and 2014, a practice widely criticized by wildlife advocates but eventually upheld by a state court. David Meach, a wolf researcher with the U.S. Geological Service, said that invariably dogs are the ones that lose those fights. "I don't know of any case where dogs have killed wolves," he said. "That's why the DNR tells hunters where they should stay away from. If they are going to turn them loose in an area where they are apt to get killed, that's the hunter's fault." Piers Carlesco said his review of compensation cases show a relatively small number of hunters are quote-unquote repeat offenders. He asked the Fish and Wildlife Service to investigate 22 individuals. The list includes one who was compensated for 3 different wolf encounters in 9 days and another who was convicted of poaching and intentional mistreatment of animals, who was then compensated twice for the loss of dogs. In our second piece, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife reports the smack owl pack in Stevens County has not attacked cattle since the agency killed 2 wolves. This is from the Capitol Press, published on August 11th. Washington wildlife managers are watching to see whether the smackout wolf pack in Stevens County attacks more cattle before deciding whether to kill more wolves, the State Department of Fish and Wildlife said Thursday. The WDFW killed 2 wolves before pausing on July 30th. The department has not verified any new depredation since then. The department may consider initiating another incremental lethal removal period directed at the smackout pack, but only if the WFW finds evidence of a new depredation after the last removal period ended, according to the department's weekly update. WDFW began targeting the pack on July 20th after the 4th depredation in the past 10 months, meeting the threshold for the department to cull a pack. Wildlife managers confirmed a 5th depredation on July 22nd. Following a new wolf control policy, WDFW targeted wolves sooner than in previous years, hoping that the shooting of the 2 wolves would deter the rest of the pack. Previously, WFW waited longer to intervene, but with initial plans to shoot several wolves. WDFW shot 7 wolves in a profanity pack last year. WDFW has reported that the 5 cattle attack by the smackout pack since September 21st belonged to 3 different producers or ranchers. In the most recent depredation, wolves injured a calf in a private 40-acre fence pasture. The calf was bitten in several places by wolves, according to investigators. The other 4 depredations, 3 in September and 1 in July, occurred on federal grazing land, according to the WDFW. WDFW has not released further details about the operation, holding back details such as how the wolves were killed and their sexes and ages. Their withholding of information has upset conservation groups, including some with representatives on the department's Wolf Advisory Group. Conservation groups say WFW's tight-lipped approach has undermined trust in the department and created an information vacuum, which could be filled by rumors and misinformation. The group states their complaint in an August 4th letter to WFW. The letter was signed by 15 organizations, including 5 that are on the Wolf Advisory Group. Those 5 are Defenders of Wildlife, Conservation Northwest, the Kettle Range Conservation Group, Humane Society of the United States, and Wolf Haven International. Our third missive, Wolf Talk Radio launches a new website. I'm sure that those of you that have gone to www.wolftalkradio.com are seeing something totally new. And we are very, very proud of the work that Deanna Moose and her team have put in to get the website up and running. you will note that the intent of the reworking of the website was to make for interactive headers that takes the visitors to a host of user-friendly sections within the website. A few were still under construction, so please bear with us, and are in need of updating and loading of information. But we wanted to present the site as is. It's probably 80% complete. Incorporated into the new website are blogs that we will use for things entitled Love of Wolves, the Tejas Den with Mr. Jerry Mills, and Rachel Tilsis Wolf Tracker information. There's a programming section that our listeners and users will have offerings for listening to past episodes and to listen to past episodes of not only the show, but segments of Ask Cat, the Vet Tech is in, and other timely informational aspects that are loaded into that section. There's a section called The Howl, which is going to offer real-time articles that are relevant to all types of wolf and wolf dog issues, including animal husbandry, keeping up with different news items from around the world. So we invite you to take a look and a listen, visit all the different sites that are on the new website. We're going to be offering a bio section that explains a little about everyone that's involved with Wolf Dog Radio. There'll be resources for wolf dogs and wolves, and there'll also be an online product store. So we invite you to all check it out, take a look. We invite your comments and suggestions. If you have any or any comments about the website, if you would please send those to questions@wolfdogradio.com, and we would be much appreciative. And the last thing I'd like to touch on tonight is we all know that there's going to be a solar eclipse that's going to cross from Oregon across the United States towards North Carolina. Please, if you are one of the throng of millions that will be in the path of and going to watch this event, make sure that you have proper eye protection, because it's no joke. If you look at this directly without proper eye protection, and it's more of a certain percentage of an eclipse, you can do permanent lasting damage to the retina of your eye, and they don't have a lot of retina replacements. So please take the appropriate actions. There are different sites online that you can go to, and you can see how to make different things to protect yourself from not viewing directly at the eclipse. They are really neat. I've seen a couple in my lifetime. The last one when I was a kid, and we did the old pinhole on a piece of cardboard facing your back to the eclipse. So it does work. And thank you. That's it for In the News. We hope you enjoy the rest of the broadcast. Thank you.
We present a new segment for Wolf Dog Radio. We call it Time for Wolves. It is presented by one of the Wolves' most staunch advocates and new contributing member to Wolf Dog Radio, Rachel Tilsa.
This is Rachel Tilsa, roving reporter for Wolf Dog Radio. In the news in Wisconsin, there's a couple stories that we'll be diving into, going more into depth. But for now, I just want to give you a little bit of an intro on what's happening in the Great Lakes, and particularly in Wisconsin, for wolves. The first story affecting gray wolves in Wisconsin was that the Wisconsin D.C. Appellate Court 3-0 decision to retain protection for the gray wolves in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan. The court cited that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had not sufficiently considered how loss of historical territory would affect the predator's recovery and how removing the Great Lakes population segment from the endangered species list would affect wolves in other parts of the nation. So wolves, in effect, remain now on the endangered species list. But don't sit back on your laurels. There's some other things that you have to work with. You have to keep calling your Congress and telling them don't delist wolves, especially if there are toxic riders attached. What Congress is trying to do now is to return wolves back into the management of states like Wisconsin. And these states have proven that they are hostile to wolves. So their management practices are only about hunting. So stay tuned for more on that story. The next story that I want to bring up is a story that I was involved in. I had decided that I needed to call somebody about this because I've been doing tracking wolves for almost 20 years and helping to monitor wolf recovery of these endangered species wolves. And I got to thinking, hounders from July 1st all the way through to the end of their hunting season, end of September, are running their hounds that are pursuing bear right through rendezvous sites. And a rendezvous site is where puppies are kept. So this causes a conflict. So for decades, there has been a conflict between, bear hunters and wolves. And I got to thinking, they're getting paid an awful lot of money as well. The Wisconsin Depredation Program, Wolf Depredation Program, was started to help people living in wolf country and living among wolves to help them, to compensate them, living with wolves, compensate any damages that they do. But at this point, it was $99,000 was paid out in 2016 for a total of 41 hunting dogs that were killed, and these were mostly bear dogs. As the story is unfolding, I thought, what's going on here? I called Fish and Wildlife Services and began to talk with them, asking them, the one in the Great Lakes region, what can be done about this? Who is protecting wolves? They are an endangered species, and who's protecting them? So I called them, and then after that, I decided, I'm just going to call. I've been hearing good things about the Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility here. So I thought about calling them. So I called them, and I got a hold of Adam Carlesco, the attorney for PEER, and we got to talking. And in the end, after talking with him for almost a month, the second story that is affecting Wisconsin wolves is that the Public Employees for the Environmental Responsibility, PEER, is filed a complaint, a criminal complaint, citing state payments to hunters to compensate for upper dogs killed or injured in clashes is in violation. So the criminal investigation for violation of the Endangered Species Act, PEER staff Adam Carlesco states, and during endangered species are legally protected from human activity, which adversely affects the animal. It's not just physical injury, but harm to habitat or breeding. Losing packs of dogs on them absolutely constitutes an adverse impact. So there you have it. Again, he says, Wisconsin encourages hunting practices that seem calculated to cause fatal conflicts with wolves. And that's what Adam Carlesco said. So that is out. That's going to be our next story that we're working on. So stay tuned for more on this. And again, this is Rachel Tilseth, a reporter with Wolf Dog Radio.
Krista Ward, a resident vet tech, is in. Take it away, Krista.
The Vet Tech is in.
Thank you for listening to The Vet Tech is in. My name is Krista Ward, and tonight we will be discussing skin allergies. Skin allergies is a very serious condition, or it can be, that many veterinarians treat all across the United States and all over the world. Skin allergies are not limited to climate or diet, but can also be caused by stress as well as some other issues that we will get into later. Skin allergies can be treated in many different ways depending upon what your veterinarian sees fit. The first and foremost, we like to discuss diet. What is your pet eating? Diet is a major, major topic discussion that many veterinarians will refuse to get into with their... Thank you for listening to The Vet Tech Is In. My name is Krista Ward, and tonight we will be discussing skin allergies. Skin allergies are often overlooked by owners if they are mild, but they can also increase and become a little more severe. When that happens, we often seek veterinary advice. Skin allergies are not limited to just climate or region, but can also be an effect of a dog's diet. What do you feed your dog? That is the most important question every veterinarian should ask you. Many dogs are not allergic to grain, as though we once thought, but are mainly allergic to whatever protein that you're feeding your dog. If you've been feeding your dog chicken primarily in whatever food that you choose to feed, or if you're feeding raw, and you notice that they're itching, scratching, and they're just not improving on any kind of medication or regimen, the best thing to do is to seek veterinary advice and ask about diet change. Perhaps your pet is allergic to chicken, so maybe your veterinarian would suggest feeding something a little more off-label or feeding something such as salmon or lamb or venison. Another food product that is overlooked a lot that can help tremendously would be an additive such as sweet potatoes, which can help with the coat and skin. You can also feed raw sweet potatoes to your pet. Another good option would be, for a filler, some carrots or apples. Another great protein is beef, beef hearts, or liver. Not all pet owners want to try raw diets or grain-free diets, so talking to your veterinarian is the most important thing to get advice on the best diet for your pet and what suits their needs. Allergies can also be caused by whatever climate that your pet lives in. Seasonal allergies typically are in the more tropical climates or in the southern atmosphere. Seasonal allergies will come and go with usually summer to spring months being the heightened period, whereas in winter we will see a decrease in allergies and itching. When that occurs, veterinarians will typically treat with temporary medications. If your pet is already on a diet and you're comfortable feeding that diet and would rather try medications, it is best to start with something very mild. Many owners will start with trying to administer Benadryl to their patient. Always, always, always ask a veterinarian before you administer any medication over the counter or given by them. You want to follow instructions correctly so that you don't end up hurting your beloved canine friend. Some medications over the counter would be hydroxyzine or Benadryl. Those are very mild antihistamines and will typically stop an itch response for a short period of time, such as 8 to 12 hours. These medications can be given up to 3 times a day, as seen fit by your veterinarian. If the antihistamines aren't cutting it for you or for your pet, the best option would be to go to another mild steroid alternative that is not actually considered a steroid by the FDA, and that would be Apoquil. Apoquil is highly sought after and recommended currently by veterinarians all across the world. Apoquil acts like a steroid where it stops the itch response quickly, and many, many pet owners are seeing a response to the medication in a positive way because they're seeing their pet's hair grow back, less redness, less irritation, and the pet is overall happier. It also doesn't come with the same side effects as a steroid. Steroids are always a last option for your pet. We do not want to give any pet steroids if we can avoid it. If your veterinarian recommends administering steroids to your pet, always have a blood panel checked first to make sure that their liver values are okay before you want to start any kind of steroid or steroid regimen. There are also steroid injections that only last a week that your veterinarian can administer if they see fit, and those are a little bit safer. And they also have less side effects. Some veterinarians may also recommend antibiotics depending upon the skin condition. Some skin allergies require antibiotics because they become infected. When your pet itches and scratches and they create open wounds and scabs, sometimes that can lead to a secondary infection or a bacterial infection. At that time, it's absolutely necessary to treat with antibiotics to make sure that your pet doesn't get sicker. Another option would be if your pet is not getting any relief from any medications, perhaps doing a skin culture or a fungal culture on your pet. Those are also available at your veterinarian, and they can recommend which they prefer for you. A skin scrape would rule out any kind of mite, such as Demodex or sarcoptic mange. Demodex is a non-contagious form of mange that is oftentimes transmitted through the mother at birth. All pets are born with Demodex. Their immune system depends on if it ever becomes present outside. Sarcoptic mange is contagious to other canines and to people. So it is best to always seek veterinary advice and veterinary care if your pet is super itchy and you are concerned about mange. Some shampoos and sprays may help your pet, especially a hydrocortisone type spray. There are many available at your veterinarian that would be very beneficial and helpful. I actually treated one of my own dogs that had severe allergies years ago that had lost a majority of his hair when he was at another person's house and when I had to rescue him. I did a couple of treatments of a fungal shampoo and a steroid spray and some oral antibiotics prescribed by my veterinarian, and he completely came around, also with a good change in diet. So there are many aspects to skin issues that we always want to seek veterinary advice for, but you have many options that you can look into that are over-the-counter as well, such as, like I said before, diet, some over-the-counter medications such as hydroxyzine or Benadryl, and some shampoos and sprays. Please always call your veterinarian if you have any questions about your pet's skin. And thank you for listening again. This is Krista Ward, and the Vet Tech is out.
Thank you, Rachel Tilseth, and what a great show, Krista, on allergies. I look forward to co-hosting a show with you in the near future. Wolfdog Radio received a letter from Nick Jans, and we wanted to share it with our listeners. Cat Wolf Dancer pre-recorded the contents of this letter.
Hi, gentle listeners. We received this message from Nick Jans, and we would like to share this with our Wolfdog Radio audience. The Romeo exhibit was completed this January in Juneau, Alaska. It's a Smithsonian quality display complete with interpretive panels, a bronze cast of his paw print, and a sound wand that you can lift and hear his recorded howls. Plus, he looks so alive he seems about to blink, stretch, and rise. The resemblance to him in particular is also just uncanny. Big local crowd, ribbon-cutting ceremony, speeches and presentations, and many, many damp eyes. But what I really felt was all the positive emotion in that space. More than 200 people, many of them who knew this wolf, gathered together 7 years after his death. More than 500,000 people will see his exhibit at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center this year. The guy kneeling at the power saw in one of those shots is me. That's me as in Nick Jans. I worked alongside the professionals from framework to final touch-ups. Still ahead is an outdoor kiosk in downtown Juneau with photos of Romeo and a sign welcoming the many visitors we have to Juneau. Home of Romeo, the friendly black wolf. It's already more than halfway planned, and we're still collecting donations. Any overflow will be donated to the Forest Service to paint a scenery mural behind the exhibit at the Visitor Center. Best wishes, Nick. NickJans.com. That's NickJans.com. Thanks so much for helping keep Romeo alive. P.S. In Poland, the book, of course translated, has already sold out its first printing. 6 languages in addition to English and counting. Nick, because of you, Romeo is still alive for all of us. Gentle listeners, make sure you go to www.wolfdogradio.com and see Nick Jans's page of this exhibit, and please support this effort. Thanks for your time.
Now it's time for everyone's favorite Raging Cajun, Jerry Mills.
Hi, this is Jerry Mills. You have entered the Wolf Tejas Den. Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you'd better start swimming, or you'll sink like a stone, for the times, they are a-changing. Words so true and still timely by Bob Dylan. When I thought of these words over the years, I've heard them ring true for several things, good and bad. Personal moments in my life, others' lives, the fate of humanity, ideologies, and the world as a whole. My current thoughts with Bob's lyrics and message turns to my thoughts to wolves and wolf dogs, whose fate and very existence is in the hands of humans. Scary thought, as we seem to destroy everything we touch. Wolves' existence is based on our acceptance and habitat. Wolves will survive if given these two generosities, and I say generosities because that's what it has turned into since we have taken their God-given rights to exist away from them. You know, man fears what he don't understand, and he kills what he fears. Understanding the wolf through education helps, but, you know, at the end of the day, and class is dismissed, people think, wow, man, that's really cool about wolves, but, you know, they're still wolves, and wolves are bad. Well, wolf dogs, their fate is also at the hands of humans. Our rights to keep these animals as our chosen companion lies in the hands of the public's perception of these animals, and as wolves as a whole. We have a lot more control over these perceptions by how we keep and represent these animals, being good owners and good neighbors. Sad to say, but, you know, that, I would even have to be mentioned, but that means keeping your animals secure and not running rampant through the neighborhoods, killing other people's pets and livestock. That also means not letting small children get their hands, arms, and faces jerked off. Sad to have to say that, but that's true as well, and it's been happening more and more often, and will, sadly enough, probably continue. You know, that means being responsible. These animals all have a source, the wellspring from which they flow. Those sources are the breeders and the puppy producers. You know, that's two entirely different things. Breeders know what they're producing. They know their lines, and they have a goal of a particular animal they produce. The dogs come first. Puppy producers simply have puppies to sell with little to no lines and clueless to what they're producing, but cute wolf dog puppies for sale. Well, you know, that fact alone is going to cause the demise of wolf dogs. The blood gets thinner and thinner till it's gone. More and more animals flooding the market. Everyone with a pair of animals getting on the money wagon as they see it. Well, there are more animals than there are qualified homes now. Have been for quite some time. It's growing at an exponential rate. It'll all come to a head one day, and it'll be over unless we stop. Breeders will, without the lines, and will have to quit breeding. Breeders will have to secure homes far in advance of pairing their animals. Home checks will be essential. You know, all these things that we preach about responsibility will have to become a reality or there will be a new reality. Yes, times are a-changing, and they aren't changing for the better for wolf dogs. You know, wolf dogs used to be a specialty animal. They weren't easy to get. They're now a fad. They're everywhere. All it takes is money to get one. They are lined up at the puppy producer's door waiting on a pup, any pup. Well, they are wolf dogs. Yep, that they are. They're lined up the rescue sanctuary's doors trying to get rid of them. So come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Well, that's all I have tonight. Thank you for visiting. This is Jerry from the Wolf Tejas Den. Good night.
No going back now. Can't change your mind.
From the moment a puppy comes into the world, the soul of a wolf is also born. And even as adults, they continue to share an evolutionary connection, one that's best reflected in their love for meat. That's why there's Blue Wilderness. It's made with more of the meat your dog desires. Blue Wilderness, because inside your dog lives the soul of a wolf.
This is Linda Michaels, and you are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Tonight, we had the pleasure to interview Dr. L. David Meech for a second time. The insights into his almost 60 years of hands-on research and authoring countless books and articles and scientific papers brings us a rare look inside information few have the responsibility to care for. Thank you, Dave, for speaking with us again and you sharing your knowledge and perspectives with our listeners. Our next show features Dr. Mark Beckoff, Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Colorado Boulder, a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society and a past Guggenheim Fellow. In 2000, he was awarded the Exemplar Award from the Animal Behavior Society for major long-term contributions to the field of animal behavior. Mark is also an ambassador for Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots program, in which he works with students of all ages, senior citizens, and prisoners, and also is a member of the Ethics Committee of the Jane Goodall Institute. He and Jane co-founded the organization Ethologists for Ethical Treatment of Animals. Citizens for Responsible Animal Behavior Studies in 2000. You don't want to miss the next show. So I just want to say in closing that I had a great opportunity, and we at Wolf Dog Radio had an amazing opportunity. Some of the things that happen are done for a reason. And that reason being, we need to make the wolf dog world a little bit smaller. Right now, we are centered on ourselves and not so much on the animals. I think one of the things that we can do to help change that is by visiting each other, spending time with each other. I had a great opportunity to go to England this year, and I got to spend time with Natalie Lagstrom and, of course, Julie Bradshaw. It helps when you visit people and you talk. The world becomes smaller, and we realize we don't have that many differences. In the end, people, it's always about the wolf dog, no matter where you stand. If you have any questions about the show, please email us at questions@wolfdogradio.com and come check out our new, updated, and innovative website at www.wolfdogradio.com for more information. This is George Stapleton. It's all about the wolf dogs. Talk to you soon.
You are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.